There's lots of women around. Butch paradise, you might call it. Now she's teasing, showing some energy, and I feel better. Do they let you? I say. Let? Hell, they encourage it. Know what they call this place among themselves? Jezebels. The aunts figure we're all damned anyway. They've given up on us, so it doesn't matter what sort of vice we get up to. And the commanders don't give a piss what we do in our off time. Anyway, women on women sort of turns them on. What about the others? I say. Put it this way, she says. They're not too fond of men. She shrugs again. It might be resignation. Here is what I'd like to tell. I'd like to tell a story about how Moira escaped for good this time. Or if I couldn't tell that, I'd like to say she blew up Jezebel's with 50 commanders inside it. I'd like her to end with something daring and spectacular, some outrage, something that would befit her. But as far as I know, that didn't happen. I don't know how she ended, or even if she did, because I never saw her again. Chapter 39. The commander has a room key. He got it from the front desk while I waited on the flowered sofa. He shows it to me slyly. I am to understand. We ascend in the glass half-egg of the elevator, past the vine-draped balconies. I am to understand also that I'm on display. He unlocks the door of the room. Everything is the same, the very same as it was once upon a time. The drapes are the same, the heavy flowered ones that match the bedspread, orange poppies on royal blue, and the thin white ones to draw against the sun. The bureau and bedside tables, square-cornered, impersonal. The lamps, the pictures on the walls, fruit in a bowl, stylized apples, flowers in a vase, buttercups and devil's paintbrushes keyed to the drapes. All is the same. I tell the commander just a minute and go into the bathroom. My ears are ringing from the smoke. The gin has filled me with lassitude. I wet a washcloth and press it to my forehead. After a while, I look to see if there are any little bars of soap in individual wrappers. There are, the kind with the gypsy on them, from Spain. I breathe in the soap smell, the disinfectant smell, and stand in the white bathroom, listening to the distant sounds of water running, toilets being flushed. In a strange way, I feel comforted, at home. There is something reassuring about the toilets. Bodily functions at least remain democratic. Everybody shits, as Moira would say. I sit on the edge of the bathtub, gazing at the blank towels. Once they would have excited me. They would have meant the aftermath of love. I saw your mother, Moira said. Where? I said. I felt jolted, thrown off. I realized I'd been thinking of her as dead. Not in person. It was in that film they showed us about the colonies. There was a close-up. It was her, all right. She was wrapped up in one of those gray things, but I know it was her. Thank God, I said. Why thank God? Said Moira. I thought she was dead. She might as well be, said Moira. You should wish it for her. I can't remember the last time I saw her. It blends in with all the others. It was some trivial occasion. She must have dropped by. She did that. She breezed in and out of my house as if I were the mother and she were the child. She still had that jauntiness. Sometimes, when she was between apartments, just moving into one or just moving out, she'd use my washer-dryer for her laundry. Maybe she'd come over to borrow something from me. A pot, a hairdryer. That, too, was a habit of hers. I didn't know it would be the last time, or else I would have remembered it better. I can't even remember what we said. A week later, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, when things had become suddenly so much worse, I tried to call her, but there was no answer, and no answer when I tried again. She hadn't told me she was going anywhere, but then maybe she wouldn't have. She didn't always. She had her own car, and she wasn't too old to drive. Finally, I got the apartment superintendent on the phone. He said he hadn't seen her lately, I was worried. I thought maybe she'd had a heart attack or a stroke. It wasn't out of the question, though she hadn't been sick that I knew of. She was always so healthy. She still worked out at Nautilus and went swimming every 2 weeks. I used to tell my friends she was healthier than I was, and maybe it was true. Luke and I drove across into the city, and Luke bullied the superintendent into opening up the apartment. "She could be dead on the floor," Luke said. "The longer you leave it, the worse it'll be. You thought of the smell?" The superintendent said something about needing a permit, but Luke could be persuasive. He made it clear we weren't going to wait or go away. I started to cry. Maybe that was what finally did it. When the man got the door open, what we found was chaos. There was furniture overturned, the mattress was ripped open, bureau drawers upside down on the floor, their contents strewn and mounded. But my mother wasn't there. "I'm going to call the police," I said. I'd stopped crying. I felt cold from head to foot. My teeth were chattering. "Don't," said Luke. "Why not?" I said. I was glaring at him. I was angry now. He stood there in the wreck of the living room, just looking at me. He put his hands into his pockets, one of those aimless gestures people make when they don't know what else to do. "Just don't," is what he said. "Your mother's neat," Moira would say when we were at college. Later, "She's got pizzazz." Later still, "She's cute." "She's not cute," I would say. "She's my mother." "Geez," said Moira. "You ought to see mine." I think of my mother sweeping up deadly toxins, the way they used to use up old women in Russia sweeping dirt. Only this dirt will kill her. I can't quite believe it. Surely her cockiness, her optimism and energy, her pizzazz will get her out of this. She will think of something. But I know this isn't true. It's just passing the buck, as children do, to mothers. I've mourned for her already. But I will do it again. And again. I bring myself back to the here, to the hotel. This is where I need to be. Now, in this ample mirror under the white light, I take a look at myself. It's a good look, slow and level. I'm a wreck. The mascara has smudged again, despite Moira's repairs. The purplish lipstick has bled. Hair trails aimlessly. The molting pink feathers are tawdry as carnival dolls, and some of the starry sequins have come off. Probably they were off to begin with, and I didn't notice. I'm a travesty, in bad makeup and someone else's clothes. Used glitz. I wish I had a toothbrush. I could stand here and think about it, but time is passing. I must be back at the house before midnight, otherwise I'll turn into a pumpkin. Or was that the coach? Tomorrow's the ceremony, according to the calendar. So tonight Serena wants me serviced, and if I'm not there, she'll find out why, and then what? And the commander, for a change, is waiting. I can hear him pacing in the main room. Now he pauses outside the bathroom door, clears his throat, a stagey ahem. I turn on the hot water tap to signify readiness or something approaching it. I should get this over with. I wash my hands. I must beware of inertia. When I come out, he's lying down on the king-size bed with, I note, his shoes off. I lie down beside him. I don't have to be told. I would rather not, but it's good to lie down. I'm so tired. Alone at last, I think. The fact is that I don't want to be alone with him, not on a bed. I'd rather have Serena there, too. I'd rather play Scrabble. But my silence does not deter him. "Tomorrow, isn't it?" he says softly. "I thought we could jump the gun." He turns towards me. "Why did you bring me here?" I say, coldly. He's stroking my body now, from stem, as they say, to stern. Cat stroke along the left flank, down the left leg. He stops at the foot, his fingers encircling the ankle, briefly, like a bracelet, where the tattoo is. A braille he can read, a cattle brand. It means ownership. I remind myself that he's not an unkind man, that, under other circumstances, I even like him. His hand pauses. I thought you might enjoy it for a change. He knows that isn't enough. I guess it was a sort of experiment. That isn't enough either. You said you wanted to know. He sits up, begins to unbutton. Will this be worse, to have him denuded of all his cloth power? He's down to the shirt then, under it, sadly, a little belly, wisps of hair. He pulls down one of my straps, slides his other hand in among the feathers, but it's no good. I lie there like a dead bird. He is not a monster, I think. I can't afford pride or aversion. There are all kinds of things that have to be discarded under the circumstances. Maybe I should turn the lights out, says the commander, dismayed and no doubt disappointed. I see him for a moment before he does this. Without his uniform, he looks smaller, older, like something being dried. The trouble is that I can't be, with him, any different from the way I usually am with him. Usually I'm inert. Surely there must be something here for us, other than this futility and bathos. Fake it, I scream at myself inside my head. You must remember how. Let's get this over with, or you'll be here all night. Bestir yourself. Move your flesh around. Breathe audibly. It's the least you can do. 13. Night. Chapter 40. The heat at night is worse than the heat in daytime. Even with the fan on, nothing moves, and the walls store up warmth, give it out like a used oven. Surely it will rain soon. Why do I want it? It will only mean more dampness. There's lightning far away, but no thunder. Looking out the window, I can see it, a glimmer, like the phosphorescence you get in stirred seawater, behind the sky, which is overcast and too low, and a dull gray infrared. The searchlights are off, which is not usual, a power failure. Or else Serena Joy has arranged it. I sit in the darkness. No point in having the light on, to advertise the fact that I'm still awake. I'm fully dressed in my red habit again, having shed the spangles, scraped off the lipstick with toilet paper. I hope nothing shows. I hope I don't smell of it, or of him either. She's here at midnight, as she said she'd be. I can hear her, a faint tapping, a faint shuffling on the muffling rug of the corridor, before her light knock comes. I don't say anything, but follow her back along the hall and down the stairs. She can walk faster. She's stronger than I thought. Her left hand clamps the banister, in pain maybe, but holding on, steadying her. I think she's biting her lip. She's suffering. She wants it all right, that baby. I see the two of us, a blue shape, a red shape, in the brief glass eye of the mirror as we descend. Myself. My obverse. We go out through the kitchen. It's empty. A dim nightlight's left on. It has the calm of empty kitchens at night. The bowls on the counter, the canisters and stoneware jars loom round and heavy through the shadowy light. The knives are put away into their wooden rack. I won't go outside with you, she whispers. Odd to hear her whispering, as if she's one of us. Usually wives do not lower their voices. You go out through the door and turn right. There's another door. It's open. Go up the stairs and knock. He's expecting you. No one will see you. I'll sit here. She'll wait for me then, in case there's trouble. In case Cora and Rita wake up. No one knows why. Come in from their room at the back of the kitchen. What will she say to them? That she couldn't sleep, that she wanted some hot milk, She'll be adroit enough to lie well, I can see that. The commander's in his bedroom upstairs, she says. He won't come down this late. He never does. That's what she thinks. I open the kitchen door, step out, wait a moment for vision. It's so long since I've been outside, alone, at night. Now there's thunder. The storm's moving closer. What has she done about the guardians? I could be shot for a prowler. Paid them off somehow, I hope. Cigarettes, whiskey. Or maybe they know all about it, her stud farm. Maybe if this doesn't work, she'll try them next. The door to the garage is only steps away. I cross, feet noiseless on the grass, and open it quickly, slip inside. The stairway is dark, darker than I can see. I feel my way up, stair by stair. Carpet here. I think of it as mushroom-colored. This must have been an apartment once, for a student, a young single person with a job. A lot of the big houses around here had them. A bachelor, a studio. Those were the names for that kind of apartment. It pleases me to be able to remember this. Separate entrance, it would say in the ads. And that meant you could have sex, unobserved. I reach the top of the stairs, knock on the door there. He opens it himself. Who else was I expecting? There's a lamp on. Only one, but enough light to make me blink. I look past him, not wanting to meet his eyes. It's a single room, with a fold-out bed, made up, and a kitchenette counter at the far end, and another door that must lead to the bathroom. This room is stripped down, military, minimal. No pictures on the walls, no plants. He's camping out. The blanket on the bed is gray and says, U.S. He steps back and aside to let me pass. He's in his shirt sleeves and is holding a cigarette, lit. I smell the smoke on him and the warm air of the room all over. I'd like to take off my clothes, bathe in it, rub it over my skin. No preliminaries. He knows why I'm here. He doesn't even say anything. Why fool around? It's an assignment. He moves away from me, turns off the lamp. Outside, like punctuation, there's a flash of lightning, almost no pause, and then the thunder. He's undoing my dress, a man made of darkness. I can't see his face, and I can hardly breathe, hardly stand, and I'm not standing. His mouth is on me, his hands. I can't wait, and he's moving already. Love, it's been so long. I'm alive in my skin again, arms around him, falling and water softly everywhere, never ending. I knew it might only be once. I made that up. It didn't happen that way. Here is what happened. I reach the top of the stairs, knock on the door. He opens it himself. There's a lamp on. I blink. I look past his eyes. It's a single room, the bed's made up, stripped down, military. No pictures, but the blanket says U.S. He's in his shirt sleeves. He's holding a cigarette. Here, he says to me. Have a drag. No preliminaries. He knows why I'm here. To get knocked up. To get in trouble. Up the pole. Those were all names for it once. I take the cigarette from him. Draw deeply in. Hand it back. Our fingers hardly touch. Even that much smoke makes me dizzy. He says nothing, just looks at me, unsmiling. It would be better, more friendly, if he would touch me. I feel stupid and ugly, although I know I'm not either. Still, what does he think? Why doesn't he say something? Maybe he thinks I've been slutting around at Jezebel's, with the commander or more. It annoys me that I'm even worrying about what he thinks. Let's be practical. I don't have much time, I say. This is awkward and clumsy. It isn't what I mean. I could just squirt it into a bottle and you could pour it in, he says. He doesn't smile. There's no need to be brutal, I say. Possibly he feels used. Possibly he wants something from me, some emotion, some acknowledgement that he too is human, is more than just a seed pod. I know it's hard for you. I try. He shrugs. I get paid, he says, punk surliness, but still makes no move. I get paid, you get laid, I rhyme in my head. So that's how we're going to do it. He didn't like the makeup, the spangles. We're going to be tough. You come here often? And what's a nice girl like me doing in a spot like this? I reply. We both smile. This is better. This is an acknowledgement that we are acting, for what else can we do in such a setup? Abstinence makes the heart grow fonder. We're quoting from late movies, from the time before. And the movies, then, were from a time before that. This sort of talk dates back to an era well before our own. Not even my mother talked like that, not when I knew her. Possibly nobody ever talked like that in real life. It was all a fabrication from the beginning. Still, it's amazing how easily it comes back to mind, this corny and falsely gay sexual banter. I can see now what it's for, what it was always for, to keep the core of yourself out of reach, enclosed, protected. I'm sad now. The way we're talking is infinitely sad. Faded music, faded paper flowers, worn satin, an echo of an echo. All gone away, no longer possible. Without warning, I begin to cry. At last he moves forward, puts his arms around me, strokes my back, holds me that way for comfort. Come on, he says. We haven't got much time. With his arm around my shoulders, he leads me over to the fold-out bed, lays me down. He even turns down the blanket first. He begins to unbutton, then to stroke, kisses beside my ear. No romance, he says. Okay? That would have meant something else once. Once it would have meant no strings. Now it means no heroics. It means don't risk yourself for me, if it should come to that. And so it goes. And so. I knew it might only be once. Goodbye, I thought, even at the time. Goodbye. There wasn't any thunder, though. I added that in, to cover up the sounds, which I am ashamed of making. It didn't happen that way, either. I'm not sure how it happened, not exactly. All I can hope for is a reconstruction. The way love feels is always only approximate. Partway through, I thought about Serena Joy, sitting down there in the kitchen, thinking, cheap. They'll spread their legs for anyone. All you need to give them is a cigarette. And I thought afterwards, this is a betrayal. Not the thing itself, but my own response. If I knew for certain he's dead, would that make a difference? I would like to be without shame. I would like to be shameless. I would like to be ignorant. Then I would not know how ignorant I was. 14. Salvaging. Chapter 41. I wish this story were different. I wish it were more civilized. I wish it showed me in a better light, if not happier, then at least more active, less hesitant, less distracted by trivia. I wish it had more shape. I wish it were about love, or about sudden realizations important to one's life, or even about sunsets, birds, rainstorms, or snow. Maybe it is about those things, in a way. But in the meantime, there is so much else getting in the way, so much whispering, so much speculation about others, so much gossip that cannot be verified, so many unsaid words, so much creeping about and secrecy. And there is so much time to be endured, time heavy as fried food or thick fog. And then, all at once, these red events, like explosions, on streets otherwise decorous and matronly and somnambulant. I'm sorry there is so much pain in this story. I'm sorry it's in fragments, like a body caught in crossfire or pulled apart by force. But there is nothing I can do to change it. I've tried to put some of the good things in as well. Flowers, for instance, because where would we be without them? Nevertheless, it hurts me to tell it over, over again. Once was enough. Wasn't once enough for me at the time? But I keep on going with this sad and hungry and sordid, this limping and mutilated story, because after all, I want you to hear it, as I will hear yours too if I ever get the chance, if I meet you or if you escape in the future or in heaven or in prison or underground, some other place. What they have in common is that they're not here. By telling you anything at all, I'm at least believing in you. I believe you're there. I believe you into being. Because I'm telling you this story, I will your existence. I tell. Therefore, you are. So I will go on. So I will myself to go on. I am coming to a part you will not like at all, because in it I did not behave well. But I will try, nonetheless, to leave nothing out. After all you've been through, you deserve whatever I have left. Which is not much, but includes the truth. This is the story, then. I went back to Nick, time after time on my own, without Serena knowing. It wasn't called for, there was no excuse. I did not do it for him, but for myself entirely. I didn't even think of it as giving myself to him, because what did I have to give? I did not feel munificent, but thankful each time he would let me in. He didn't have to. In order to do this, I became reckless. I took stupid chances. After being with the commander, I would go upstairs in the usual way, but then I would go along the hall and down the Martha stairs at the back and through the kitchen. Each time I would hear the kitchen door click shut behind me, and I would almost turn back. It sounded so metallic, like a mouse trap or a weapon. But I would not turn back. I would hurry across the few feet of illuminated lawn. The searchlights were back on again, expecting at any moment to feel the bullets rip through me, even in advance of their sound. I would make my way by touch up the dark staircase and come to rest against the door, the thud of blood in my ears. Fear is a powerful stimulant. Then I would knock softly, a beggar's knock. Each time I would expect him to be gone, or worse, I would expect him to say I could not come in. He might say he wasn't going to break any more rules, put his neck in the noose for my sake. Or even worse, tell me he was no longer interested. His failure to do any of these things I experienced as the most incredible benevolence and luck. I told you it was bad. Here is how it goes. He opens the door. He's in his shirt sleeves, his shirt untucked, hanging loose. He's holding a toothbrush or a cigarette or a glass with something in it. He has his own little stash up here, black market stuff, I suppose. He's always got something in his hand, as if he's been going about his life as usual, not expecting me, not waiting. Maybe he doesn't expect me or wait. Maybe he has no notion of the future, or does not bother or dare to imagine it. Is it too late? I say. He shakes his head for no. It is understood between us by now that it's never too late, but I go through the ritual politeness of asking. It makes me feel more in control, as if there is a choice, a decision that could be made one way or the other. He steps aside and I move past him and he closes the door. Then he crosses the room and closes the window. After that, he turns out the light. There is not much talking between us anymore, not at this stage. Already I am half out of my clothes. We save the talking for later. With the commander, I close my eyes, even when I'm only kissing him goodnight. I do not want to see him up close. But now, here, each time I keep my eyes open. I would like a light on somewhere, a candle perhaps, stuck into a bottle, some echo of college, but anything like that would be too great a risk. So I have to make do with the searchlight, the glow of it from the grounds below, filtered through his white curtains, which are the same as mine. I want to see what can be seen of him, take him in, memorize him, save him up so I can live on the image later. The lines of his body, the texture of his flesh, the glisten of sweat on his pelt, his long, sardonic, unrevealing face. I ought to have done that with Luke, paid more attention to the details, the moles and scars, the singular creases. I didn't, and he's fading. Day by day, night by night, he recedes, and I become more faithless. For this one, I'd wear pink feathers, purple stars, if that were what he wanted, or anything else, even the tail of a rabbit. But he does not require such trimmings. We make love each time as if we know, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that there will never be any more for either of us with anyone, ever. And then, when there is, that too is always a surprise, extra, a gift. Being here with him is safety. It's a cave where we huddle together while the storm goes on outside. This is a delusion, of course. This room is one of the most dangerous places I could be. If I were caught, there would be no quarter, but I'm beyond caring. And how have I come to trust him like this, which is foolhardy in itself? How can I assume I know him, or the least thing about him and what he really does? I dismiss these uneasy whispers. I talk too much. I tell him things I shouldn't. I tell him about Moira, about of Glenn. Not about Luke, though. I want to tell him about the woman in my room, the one who was there before me, but I don't. I'm jealous of her. If she's been here before me, too, in this bed, I don't want to hear about it. I tell him my real name and feel that therefore I am known. I act like a dunce. I should know better. I make of him an idol, a cardboard cutout. He, on the other hand, talks little. No more hedging or jokes. He barely asks questions. He seems indifferent to most of what I have to say, alive only to the possibilities of my body, though he watches me while I'm speaking. He watches my face. Impossible to think that anyone for whom I feel such gratitude could betray me. Neither of us says the word love, not once. It would be tempting fate. It would be romance. Bad luck. Today there are different flowers. Drier, more defined. The flowers of high summer. Daisies, black-eyed Susans, starting us on the long downward slope to fall. I see them in the gardens as I walk with of Glenn to and fro. I hardly listen to her. I no longer credit her. The things she whispers seem to me unreal. What use are they for me now? You could go into his room at night, she says. Look through his desk. There must be papers, notations. The door is locked, I murmur. We could get you a key, she says. Don't you want to know who he is, what he does? But the commander is no longer of immediate interest to me. I have to make an effort to keep my indifference towards him from showing. Keep on doing everything exactly the way you were before, Nick says. Don't change anything. Otherwise, they'll know. He kisses me, watching me all the time. Promise? Don't slip up. I put his hand on my belly. It's happened, I say. I feel it has. A couple of weeks, and I'll be certain. This, I know, is wishful thinking. He'll love you to death, he says. So will she. But it's yours, I say. It will be yours, really. I want it to be. We don't pursue this, however. I can't, I say to of Glenn. I'm too afraid. Anyway, I'd be no good at that. I'd get caught. I scarcely take the trouble to sound regretful. So lazy have I become. We could get you out, she says. We can get people out if we really have to, if they're in danger, immediate danger. The fact is that I no longer want to leave, escape, cross the border to freedom. I want to be here, with Nick, where I can get at him. Telling this, I'm ashamed of myself. But there's more to it than that. Even now, I can recognize this admission as a kind of boasting. There's pride in it, because it demonstrates how extreme and therefore justified it was for me. How well worth it. It's like stories of illness and near death from which you have recovered, like stories of war. They demonstrate seriousness. Such seriousness about a man, then, had not seemed possible to me before. Some days I was more rational. I did not put it to myself in terms of love. I said, I have made a life for myself here, of a sort. That must have been what the settlers' wives thought, and women who survived wars if they had a man. Humanity is so adaptable, my mother would say. Truly amazing what people can get used to, as long as there are a few compensations. It won't be long now, says Cora, doling out my monthly stack of sanitary napkins. Not long now, smiling at me shyly, but also knowingly. Does she know? Do she and Rita know what I'm up to, creeping down their stairs at night? Do I give myself away, daydreaming, smiling at nothing, touching my face lightly when I think they aren't watching? Evglenn is giving up on me. She whispers less, talks more about the weather. I do not feel regret about this. I feel relief. Chapter 42. The bell is tolling. We can hear it from a long way off. It's morning, and today we've had no breakfast. When we reach the main gate, we file through it, two by two. There's a heavy contingent of guards, special detail angels with riot gear, the helmets with the bulging dark plexiglass visors that make them look like beetles, the long clubs, the gas canister guns, in cordon around the outside of the wall. That's in case of hysteria. The hooks on the wall are empty. This is a district salvaging, for women only. Salvagings are always segregated. It was announced yesterday. They tell you only the day before. It's not enough time to get used to it. To the tolling of the bell, we walk along the paths once used by students, past buildings that were once lecture halls and dormitories. It's very strange to be in here again. From the outside, you can't tell that anything's changed, except that the blinds on most of the windows are drawn down. These buildings belong to the eyes now. We file onto the wide lawn in front of what used to be the library. The white steps going up are still the same. The main entrance is unaltered. There's a wooden stage erected on the lawn, something like the one they used every spring for commencement in the time before. I think of hats, pastel hats worn by some of the mothers, and of the black gowns the students would put on, and the red ones. But this stage is not the same after all, because of the three wooden posts that stand on it, with the loops of rope. At the front of the stage there is a microphone. The television camera is discreetly off to the side. I've only been to one of these before, 2 years ago. Women's salvagings are not frequent. There is less need for them. These days we are so well behaved. I don't want to be telling the story. We take our places in the standard order. Wives and daughters on the folding wooden chairs placed towards the back, Econo wives and Marthas around the edges and on the library steps, and handmaids at the front, where everyone can keep an eye on us. We don't sit on chairs, but kneel, and this time we have cushions, small red velvet ones with nothing written on them, not even faith. Luckily, the weather is all right. Not too hot, cloudy bright. It would be miserable kneeling here in the rain. Maybe that's why they leave it so late to tell us, so they'll know what the weather will be like. That's as good a reason as any. I kneel on my red velvet cushion. I try to think about tonight, about making love in the dark, and light reflected off the white walls. I remember being held. There's a long piece of rope that winds like a snake in front of the first row of cushions, along the second, and back through the lines of chairs, bending like a very old, very slow river viewed from the air, down to the back. The rope is thick and brown and smells of tar. The front end of the rope runs up onto the stage. It's like a fuse, or the string of a balloon. On the stage, to the left, are those who are to be salvaged. Two handmaids, one wife. Wives are unusual, and despite myself, I look at this one with interest. I want to know what she has done. They have been placed here before the gates were opened. All of them sit on folding wooden chairs, like graduating students who are about to be given prizes. Their hands rest in their laps, looking as if they are folded sedately. They sway a little. They've probably been given injections or pills, so they won't make a fuss. It's better if things go smoothly. Are they attached to their chairs? Impossible to say, under all that drapery. Now the official procession is approaching the stage, mounting the steps at the right. Three women, one aunt in front, two salvagers in their black hoods and cloaks a pace behind her. Behind them are the other aunts. The whisperings among us hush. The three arrange themselves, turn towards us, the aunt flanked by the two black-robed salvagers. It's Aunt Lydia. How many years since I've seen her? I'd begun to think she existed only in my head, but here she is, a little older. I have a good view. I can see the deepening furrows to either side of her nose, the engraved frown. Her eyes blink. She smiles nervously, peering to left and right, checking out the audience, and lifts a hand to fidget with her headdress. An odd strangling sound comes over the PA system. She is clearing her throat. I've begun to shiver. Hatred fills my mouth like spit. The sun comes out, and the stage and its occupants light up like a Christmas creche. I can see the wrinkles under Aunt Lydia's eyes, the pallor of the seated women, the hairs on the rope in front of me on the grass, the blades of grass. There is a dandelion right in front of me, the color of egg yolk. I feel hungry. The bell stops tolling. Aunt Lydia stands up, smooths down her skirt with both hands, and steps forward to the mic. "Good afternoon, ladies," she says. And there is an instant and ear-splitting feedback whine from the PA system. From among us, incredibly, there is laughter. It's hard not to laugh. It's the tension and the look of irritation on Aunt Lydia's face as she adjusts the sound. This is supposed to be dignified. "Good afternoon, ladies," she says again, her voice now tinny and flattened. It's ladies instead of girls because of the wives. "I'm sure we are all aware of the unfortunate circumstances that bring us all here together on this beautiful morning, when I am certain we would all rather be doing something else, at least I speak for myself. But duty is a hard taskmaster, or, may I say on this occasion, taskmistress, and it is in the name of duty that we are here today." She goes on like this for some minutes. But I don't listen. I've heard this speech, or one like it, often enough before. The same platitudes, the same slogans, the same phrases. The torch of the future. The cradle of the race. The task before us. It's hard to believe there will not be polite clapping after this speech, and tea and cookies served on the lawn. That was the prologue, I think. Now she'll get down to it. Aunt Lydia rummages in her pocket, produces a crumpled piece of paper. This she takes an undue length of time to unfold and scan. She's rubbing our noses in it, letting us know exactly who she is, making us watch her as she silently reads, flaunting her prerogative. Obscene, I think. Let's get this over with. "In the past," says Aunt Lydia, It has been the custom to precede the actual salvagings with a detailed account of the crimes of which the prisoners stand convicted. However, we have found that with such a public account, especially when televised, is invariably followed by a rash, if I may call it that, an outbreak, I should say, of exactly similar crimes. So, we have decided, in the best interests of all, to discontinue this practice. The salvagings will proceed without further ado. A collective murmur goes up from us. The crimes of others are a secret language among us. Through them we show ourselves what we might be capable of after all. This is not a popular announcement. But you would never know it from Aunt Lydia, who smiles and blinks as if washed in applause. Now we are left to our own devices, our own speculations. The first one, the one they're now raising from her chair, black-gloved hands on her upper arms. Reading? No, that's only a hand cut off, on the third conviction. Unchastity? Or an attempt on the life of her commander? Or the commander's wife, more likely. That's what we're thinking. As for the wife, there's mostly just one thing they get salvaged for. They can do almost anything to us, but they aren't allowed to kill us, not legally. Not with knitting needles or garden shears or knives purloined from the kitchen, and especially not when we are pregnant. It could be adultery, of course. It could always be that. Or attempted escape. "Of Charles," Aunt Lydia announces. No one I know. The woman is brought forward. She walks as if she's really concentrating on it. One foot, the other foot. She's definitely drugged. There's a groggy, off-center smile on her mouth. One side of her face contracts, an uncoordinated wink aimed at the camera. They'll never show it, of course. This isn't live. The two salvagers tie her hands behind her back. From behind me, there's a sound of retching. That's why we don't get breakfast. "Janine, most likely," of Glenn whispers. I've seen it before. The white bag placed over the head. The woman helped up onto the high stool, as if she's being helped up the steps of a bus, steadied there. The noose adjusted delicately around the neck, like a vestment. The stool kicked away. I've heard the long sigh go up from around me. The sigh like air coming out of an air mattress. I've seen Aunt Lydia place her hand over the mic to stifle the other sounds coming from behind her. I've leaned forward to touch the rope in front of me, in time with the others, both hands on it, the rope hairy, sticky with tar and the hot sun, then placed my hand on my heart to show my unity with the salvagers and my consent and my complicity in the death of this woman. I have seen the kicking feet, and the two in black who now seize hold of them and drag downward with all their weight. I don't want to see it anymore. I look at the grass instead. I describe the rope. Chapter 43. The three bodies hang there, even with the white sacks over their heads, looking curiously stretched, like chickens strung up by the necks in a meat shop window, like birds with their wings clipped, like flightless birds, wrecked angels. It's hard to take your eyes off them. Beneath the hems of the dresses, the feet dangle, two pairs of red shoes, one pair of blue. If it weren't for the ropes and the sacks, it could be a kind of dance, a ballet, caught by flash camera, mid-air. They look arranged. They look like showbiz. It must have been Aunt Lydia who put the blue one in the middle. "Today's salvaging is now concluded," Aunt Lydia announces into the mic. "But," we turn to her, listen to her, watch her. She's always known how to space her pauses. A ripple runs over us, a stir. Something else, perhaps, is going to happen. "But you may stand up and form a circle, She smiles down upon us, generous, munificent. She's about to give us something. Bestow. Orderly now. She's talking to us, to the handmaids. Some of the wives are leaving now, some of the daughters. Most of them stay, but they stay behind, out of the way. They watch, merely. They are not part of the circle. Two guardians have moved forward and are coiling up the thick rope, getting it out of the way. Others move the cushions. We are milling around now, on the grass space in front of the stage, some jockeying for position at the front, next to the center, many pushing just as hard to work their way to the middle, where they will be shielded. It's a mistake to hang back too obviously in any group like this. It stamps you as lukewarm, lacking in zeal. There's an energy building here, a murmur, a tremor of readiness and anger. The body's tense, the eyes are brighter, as if aiming. I don't want to be at the front, or at the back either. I'm not sure what's coming, though I sense it won't be anything I want to see up close. But Uvglen has hold of my arm. She tugs me with her, and now we're in the second line, with only a thin hedge of bodies in front of us. I don't want to see, yet I don't pull back either. I've heard rumors, which I only half believed. Despite everything I already know, I say to myself, they wouldn't go that far. You know the rules for a participation, Aunt Lydia says. You will wait until I blow the whistle. After that, what you do is up to you, until I blow the whistle again. Understood? A noise comes from among us, a formless assent. Well then, says Aunt Lydia. She nods. Two guardians, not the same ones that have taken away the rope, come forward now from behind the stage. Between them, they half carry, half drag a third man. He too is in a guardian's uniform, but he has no hat on, and the uniform is dirty and torn. His face is cut and bruised, deep reddish-brown bruises. The flesh is swollen and knobby, stubbled with unshaven beard. This doesn't look like a face, but like an unknown vegetable, a mangled bulb or tuber, something that's grown wrong. Even from where I'm standing, I can smell him. He smells of shit and vomit. His hair is blonde and falls over his face. Spiky with what? Dried sweat? I stare at him with revulsion. He looks drunk. He looks like a drunk that's been in a fight. Why have they brought a drunk in here? This man, says Aunt Lydia, has been convicted of rape. Her voice trembles with rage and a kind of triumph. He was once a guardian. He has disgraced his uniform. He has abused his position of trust. His partner in viciousness has already been shot. The penalty for rape, as you know, is death. Deuteronomy, chapter 22, verses 23 through 29. I might add that this crime involved two of you and took place at gunpoint. It was also brutal. I will not offend your ears with any details, except to say that one woman was pregnant and the baby died. A sigh goes up from us. Despite myself, I feel my hands clench. It is too much, this violation. The baby, too. After what we go through, it's true, there is a bloodlust. I want to tear, gouge, rend. We jostle forward, our heads turn from side to side, our nostrils flare, sniffing death. We look at one another, seeing the hatred. Shooting was too good. The man's head swivels groggily around. Has he even heard her? Aunt Lydia waits a moment. Then she gives a little smile and raises her whistle to her lips. We hear it, shrill and silver, an echo from a volleyball game of long ago. The two guardians let go of the third man's arms and step back. He staggers. Is he drugged? And falls to his knees. His eyes are shriveled up inside the puffy flesh of his face, as if the light is too bright for him. They've kept him in darkness. He raises one hand to his cheek, as though to feel if he's still there. All of this happens quickly, but it seems to be slowly. Nobody moves forward. The women are looking at him with horror, as if he's a half-dead rat dragging itself across a kitchen floor. He's squinting around at us, the circle of red women. One corner of his mouth moves up, incredible. A smile? I try to look inside him, inside the trashed face, see what he must really look like. I think he's about 30. It isn't Luke. But it could have been. I know that. It could be Nick. I know that whatever he's done, I can't touch him. He says something. It comes out thick, as if his throat is bruised, his tongue huge in his mouth, but I hear it anyway. He says, "I didn't." There's a surge forward, like a crowd at a rock concert in the former time, when the doors opened, that urgency coming like a wave through us. The air is bright with adrenaline. We are permitted anything, and this is freedom. In my body, also, I am reeling. Red spreads everywhere. But before that tide of cloth and bodies hits him, of Glenn is shoving through the women in front of us, propelling herself with her elbows, left, right, and running towards him. She pushes him down, sideways, then kicks his head viciously, one, two, three times, sharp, painful jabs with the foot, well aimed. Now there are sounds, gasps, a low noise like growling, yells, and the red bodies tumble forward, and I can no longer see. He's obscured by arms, fists, feet. A high scream comes from somewhere, like a horse in terror. I keep back, try to stay on my feet. Something hits me from behind. I stagger. When I regain my balance and look around, I see the wives and daughters leaning forward in their chairs, the aunts on the platform gazing down with interest. They must have a better view from up there. He has become an it. Of Glenn is back beside me. Her face is tight, expressionless. "I saw what you did," I say to her. Now I'm beginning to feel again. Shock, outrage, nausea. Barbarism. "Why did you do that? You, I thought you..." "Don't look at me," she says. "They're watching." "I don't care," I say. My voice is rising. I can't help it. "Get control of yourself," she says. She pretends to brush me off, my arm and shoulder, bringing her face close to my ear. "Don't be stupid. He wasn't a rapist at all. He was a political. He was one of ours. I knocked him out, put him out of his misery. Don't you know what they're doing to him?" "One of ours," I think. "A guardian. It seems impossible." Aunt Lydia blows her whistle again, but they don't stop at once. The two guardians move in, pulling them off from what's left. Some lie on the grass where they've been hit or kicked by accident. Some have fainted. They straggle away in twos and threes or by themselves. They seem dazed.
"You will find your partners and reform your line," Aunt Lydia says into the mic. Few pay attention to her. A woman comes towards us, walking as if she's feeling her way with her feet, in the dark. Janine. There's a smear of blood across her cheek, and more of it on the white of her headdress. She's smiling, a bright, diminutive smile. Her eyes have come loose.
"Hi there," she says. "How are you doing?"
She's holding something tightly in her right hand. It's a clump of blonde hair. She gives a small giggle. "Janine," I say. But she's let go, totally now. She's in free fall. She's in withdrawal.
"You have a nice day," she says,
and walks on past us, towards the gate. I look after her. Easy out, is what I think. I don't even feel sorry for her, although I should. I feel angry. I'm not proud of myself for this or for any of it. But then, that's the point. My hands smell of warm tar. I want to go back to the house and up to the bathroom and scrub with the harsh soap and the pumice to get every